Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. We're going to talk in detail with one of our favorite and regular contributors about Israel, about what's happening there now, what happened to it recently, what it's doing in response, and what may come next. Our guest is Dr. David Wormser. He has served in senior positions, working as a naval intelligence officer, rising through the ranks to that of a lieutenant commander. He became an advisor to an undersecretary of state, a national security advisor, and the vice president of the United States in various administrations. He is these days the Mideast program director at our Center for Security Policy, of which I'm very proud. We've gotten him back from the Middle East, where he was for the period shortly before the invasion of Israel and for several weeks thereafter, providing incredibly high quality and real-time analysis and commentary about the kinds of topics that we wanted to ask him about tonight. But with now the advantage of a little bit of hindsight, a little bit of further information. David, it's so good to have you with us. I'm so appreciative of what you did while over there, and very grateful that you're back safe and sound, and look forward to this hour-long conversation with you about some of the most important questions of the day. Welcome.
Okay. Thanks, Frank. It's good to be back, and it's always an honor to be with you here. So.
Thank you. Well, let me ask you first, David, to kind of level set with us. With 3 weeks, I guess, now of distance from the horrific terrorist attack against Israel by an internationally recognized terrorist organization, though it's not as often recognized as the Palestinian arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, which I want to talk to you a bit about. What have we learned, David, about, maybe for starters, the kind of violence that was perpetrated against Israel during those early hours of attack?
Well, we found a lot about the tactics and that they must have gotten extensive training from others because they did a lot of things right the first time without any real evidence of massive training in Gaza on it. So, for example, the use of hand gliders as a paratroop landing force, the use of Arab workers in Israel as an advanced intelligence structure. When the terrorists entered the kibbutzes, they even knew the codes of the doors. And they knew each room in every house. They had little maps. And in the maps, it said, there's a child that sleeps in this room. There's a dog in this house. This house has four people. Two are this age. They had every single piece of information you could possibly think of. And that was provided by the guest workers from Gaza, that Israel had opened up its border and allowed a lot of Arab Palestinian workers into Israel. Mm-hmm.
And this was one of the concessions to the Palestinians, yeah, and those who complained that Israel was operating an open air prison and so on. Yeah. This was giving them opportunities for gainful employment and self improvement and the like, right?
And then they used a lot of them also during the invasion. That they were the ones who gave the security guards and various Israeli families and so forth a sense of security because they recognized a lot of these people. And lo and behold, they were the ones who then opened the gates and behind them flowed all these terrorists. So what we're beginning to learn is the immense planning, grunt work that went into this, the meticulousness of it, the massive amount of training. We now have learned that there was at least an extended training period for many of this force in Iran for quite a while before the invasion. We're seeing the presence of a tremendous amount of equipment that did not come from Gaza. It is either of North Korean make or Iranian make, or quite frankly, quite a bit appears to be coming from the Taliban, the U.S. Equipment that we left behind in Afghanistan seems to be showing up. And even stuff from Libya. So it's sort of also an archaeological journey through all the weapons that have been left behind by the West over the last decades. Over the last decade, so there's a lot of that, but also the axis of evil. You're seeing equipment clearly there. So we've learned that.
And by that, you mean the axis of evil
being everything from Pyongyang, Beijing, all the way through over to Bogota and Caracas, and Venezuela. It's really a global coalition,
including Tehran.
Including Tehran is a key node of it, yes, and Moscow. So it goes all the way from one end to the other.
So it's Western supplied military gear left behind, for example, for the Taliban, and a lot of stuff that the Palestinian terrorists have allied with.
Correct.
That also were providing material support.
Right.
Now, David, let me just ask you about one aspect of this that obviously has garnered, understandably, tremendous attention. And that is the violence that was inflicted upon those sleeping children and, you know, couples and so on in the various kibbutzes and other areas that were attacked. I think it's simply unimaginable for most Americans when they hear about decapitated babies and people who's had, you know, babies in the womb ripped out of their stomachs or throat slit or whatever else. And yet, it's my understanding that much, if not all, of those techniques for terrifying and murdering are actually doctrinally prescribed in the model of the perfect man, as he's called in Islam, namely the Prophet Muhammad, under Sharia, basically, this Islamic doctrine, doctrine of, you know, conquest and submission. Is that a correct assessment?
Well, I think so. Quite a bit of this is. Muhammad and his successors, when they waged war, they were quite brutal. And much of this, you saw it with ISIS. And by the way, you also can see it simply as the common denominator of violence by this crowd. We saw it in 1929 in Hebron against Jews by the Arabs. We saw this in 48. We saw this with the Yazidis in Iraq and ISIS a few years ago. The Indians can tell you stories. Boko Haram. What you see is a consistent theme. And one, the brutality is certainly not prohibited. But on top of it all, a lot of these methods are what were done by the early Muslims and under Salafi, under Islamic thought that governs the Islamic Brotherhood and so forth. Those are models to emulate that go right back to the origins of Islam.
Yeah. And this is why when people say Hamas is the Islamic State or is, for that matter, the Taliban or Hezbollah or any of these other jihadi Sharia supremacist entities, that's why, is it not? This is the yeah. shared practice.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the shared practice. And I think the West really needs to spend a bit more time understanding early Islamic warfare.
Amen.
Because it will teach us a lot about current Islamic warfare.
It's interesting you say that. One of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, one of our senior fellows, Dr. Harold Rode, a frequent contributor to this program, wrote a book for us entitled The Islamic Way of Warfare. And that's exactly the point. This has been passed on through the generations, and it's considered to be, you know, sacred writ to do it this way. David, we have to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk a bit about some of those who are now implicated in helping not only arm and perhaps train, but also plan this horrific attack. David Wormser is in the house. Stay tuned for more right after this.
The This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. FBI Director Christopher Wray warned Congress yesterday that, quote, we are in a dangerous period as multiple terrorist organizations have called for attacks against Americans and the West, unquote. Worse yet, when asked if any such groups were operating in the United States, Wray responded, quote, well, we're not tracking that, unquote. What the FBI has been tracking are patriotic Americans who were in Washington on January 6th, school board protesting parents, traditional Catholics, and those criticizing the COVID jabs. While such misallocation of limited counterintelligence resources tracks with disastrous Biden administration priorities, any conscientious public servant would resign for his part in leaving the nation acutely vulnerable to murderous strikes by jihadists and, for that matter, Chinese special forces and others now here to do us harm. The FBI needs an overhaul and new leadership. If Christopher Wray won't resign, he should be fired. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We're visiting with Dr. David Wormser, former naval intelligence specialist in the United States Navy and a man who has served in a series of very senior and influential positions in the State Department, the National Security Council, and the Office of the Vice President, as well as, of course, a few gigs in the Pentagon. David Wormser, you're talking about lessons learned now 3 weeks on. What do we know about or believe has been established so far concerning the contributions that the axis of evil, as I think you called it, made to the planning of this horrific attack?
Well, one thing we know is on the, in the inner circle, Iran and various other proxies of Iran, whether it's Hezbollah and Iran itself, directly trained Hamas terrorists, and it counts in part for, I don't want to say professionalism, because professionals don't behead babies, but the competence in evil that was displayed by them. And I think that you can't do this stuff right the first time the way they did it. So clearly, they were heavily trained from the outside.
And when you say this stuff, it's not just the hang gliders. It was a sort of combined arms operation from the sea, from the air, from the land, underground, I guess, as well.
Well, it's the combined arms. It was the meticulous leveraging of intelligence, the command and control. I mean, this was done very well. The tactics used by the terrorists on the ground were very effective. Israeli soldiers encountering them were encountering something that was not 4, 5, 6 wild men with guns. These were highly trained, highly effective combatants, the Nukba force. And certainly there was at least 1,500 that entered up front in the very first wave. And they were all truly trained as commandos. So it was a very effective force. But and that then raises another question, which is, first of all, we know Iran has gotten training over the years from various organizations and states. But I think what you see with Hamas, there's strong rumors that seem to be rising above the level of rumor that the Wagner force might have been involved in training them to some extent.
Those would be the Russian...
Right.
Mercenaries.
And it wouldn't be entirely surprising because the Wagner force was involved with Iran and Syria. And of course, that's where the Iranians and so forth, this is, and Hezbollah, this is the sort of nexus where Hamas came together. The Radwan force among the Hezbollah is really the father force of this Nukba force that was the front wave of the Hamas terrorists. So you really are seeing sort of an integrated weaponry and training and intelligence structure. And I think one more aspect of it will be cyber, that there was a lot of cyber activity that wasn't being done locally in Gaza. It was definitely being done from abroad. And of course, Iran has reasonable cyber capabilities, but some of the things that were happening indicate really the highest level cyber capability. And that doesn't come from Iran necessarily. I think that could easily have come from China or others. So we're seeing foreign involvement, at least in preparation of this. And of course, if you're preparing a force like that, you're assuming you're going to use it. So there's a complicity.
Right. Well, if not actually a green lighting of the whole thing, which is my guess. David, there's been a lot of talk about the intelligence failure on the part of actually both the Israelis and the United States. I know in our program in the past, you've demurred about speculating about that on the grounds that there'll be a full after-action assessment and all of that will be rigorously wrung out. But is there anything else that you can share with us? I mean, for example, you mentioned cyber, and there's been speculation that may have contributed to a lessening of the, well, the reliability and situational awareness that various sensors and communication systems provided.
Well, in the days after the war, there were clearly a lot of cyber attacks. I just saw the Israelis ordered their country, at least a part of the country, to boil its water for a few hours one day because the cyber attack had taken down part of their water system, purification system, and so on and so forth. But on the day, I mean, there were lots of things that probably indicate significant cyber activity. The 911 system, both the military coordinated with the police coordinated with civilian, the entire emergency communication system just didn't seem to work. And that seemed to start shortly before the assault. As far as the intelligence failure, there's a couple things we have learned. One is, Israeli forces on the line knew. They knew something really big and really bad was going to happen. And they were yelling about it. And then you ran up into the mid and upper levels with the conceptual stubbornness that, well, no, they can't really do that. No, that's really, if that's what they're thinking of doing, then they're fantasizing. That's sort of a response. On the highest level, the intelligence estimate was that Hamas is deterred, that they don't have a vested interest. They don't have an interest at all in starting a conflict. So just a week before, you had the head of intelligence say, it is their estimate that we're entering a period of calm. And that's the reigning idea. And then, but there's a whole series of conceptual things. For example, the idea that you let your enemy build up and you can deal with him once he gets strong enough. Well, he got strong enough and they didn't deal with him. A lot of other issues, these conceptual things are what really failed. But there was also the huge intelligence failure, obviously. And the chief of intelligence was informed at 2 a.m. that something big is coming down. And his response was, go back to sleep and stop panicking.
Wow. Well, this will, I'm sure, get further, as I say, documented and hopefully responded mm-hmm. to when these after action reports are completed. David, let me just ask you, and this is not meant to be a political question. It's just, what is the nature of a democracy? I gather there are a lot of people who are blaming Benjamin Netanyahu for this failure. Is that, to your way of thinking, true to the extent that, you know, the captain of the ship is held responsible for whatever goes wrong. But on the other hand, especially with what you just shared, that would not seem, was he informed that something big was going down? And did he say, go back to sleep? Or was he not told? Do you know?
From everything we know, he was not told. There was one report he might have been told, but minutes before it happened, not that night, minutes. And not even that's clear. He was told the week before, as I said, from what we can tell, he was told that it's entering a period of calm.
Right. By the head of Israeli intelligence?
I think on an immediate intelligence failure level, I think this is probably like Golda Meir. She was blamed. And she was actually...
In 1973, you're talking
73,
about.
73, yeah. And she actually was told by her head of... I think Mossad told her that, and of course King Hussein told her and she discounted it. However, here, I'm not even sure anybody told Bibi that there's likely to be a war right now. We do have stuff from 5 years ago, sort of more theoretical. Lieberman, when he was defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, said, listen, if we don't deal with Hamas now on the ground and wipe them out, this was after the war in 2014, then they're going to come back and they're going to take the war into our cities. And he more or less predicted this. So there's maybe some background noise about conceptually some people got it. But I don't think he is really responsible for the immediate intelligence failure. But on a larger scale, he is the captain of the ship.
Yeah. And the larger policy question of whether, you know, you could continue to sort of bribe Hamas into better behavior by having, you know, people coming in and working. David, hold the thought. We're coming right back. We just have to take a short break. Stay tuned for more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Dr. David Wormser is once again with us. We are conducting an early after-action assessment and, real-time look at what's going on in connection with the fight that has been spawned by the terrorist invasion of Israel by Hamas. And we're going to turn next to the Israeli response. But David, I think I cut you off before you were able to make a final point on that previous section. So
Just very quickly, to give you an idea of how much intelligence really had dropped the ball, a year before, under the previous government, they stopped collecting information from internal communications radios in Hamas because they thought it was a waste of time. And as a result, they missed a tremendous amount of internal communication noise that would have given a strong indication. And as far as the prime minister goes, the power of a prime minister is to set the conceptual tone for the country, the bully pulpit. And that's probably the level of failure, I would put it. But frankly, the whole political structure, military structure, press structure of Israel has failed. Many people knew things they didn't want to say. It was a complacency that was universal. Mm.
Well, it certainly has cost them dearly and may yet cost them more. Speaking of which, Israeli forces are now in a counter invasion, I guess we might call it, of Gaza, following weeks, it seems, of heavy bombardment by missiles and as well as air-delivered weapons. Ground forces are now engaged, although not quite in the way that had been widely expected, with the massing of armor and other gear at the border. So how would you characterize the nature of the Israeli response to date, Dr. Wormser?
Well, in the south, I'll start with the south. They're slicing up Gaza into pieces. Namely, they're finding the relatively unpopulated seam lines between the big cities, and they're cutting into them and essentially dividing the north from the south. My bet is eventually the south from Egypt, and maybe the south can be divided into two parts. And then they methodically move through all that. One of the things that arises from the intelligence failure is that Israeli intelligence on what was going on the ground, both in terms of the hostages, as well as the tunnels and so forth, was somewhat spotty. So this salami-type invasion where they lurch forward, consolidate, they're also capturing a tremendous amount of Hamas terrorists, and with it, and civilians are coming to them. And they're learning from these people a lot. So it helps the next phase lurching forward. And to some extent, that was a direct result of that was the freeing of the one of the hostages this morning, this girl soldier that was freed early this morning. And I think you're going to see more of that. Unfortunately, Hamas knows that and may kill more of them before they fall into Israel's hands. But I think Israel is getting closer. The second thing is they're actually physically closer to the hostages when they have all these arms and fingers all the way through. I don't know if this continues in a slow motion all the way to the end, or whether they at one point suddenly lurch and do all the rest at once. So it still may be an amalgam. But they're learning a lot, and their tactics are improving a lot. And so far, Israel has had two injuries, but no dead soldiers, and that's it. And they've already taken they're about 5-6 kilometers down the coast on the sea. They've cut the north off from the south at this point and have taken a good chunk of the north. So it really, they have, their tactics seem to be working exceptionally. In the north, you see a similar learning curve. The first week of the war, Israel lost 5 soldiers up there to anti-tank fire and even 1 mortar fire. In the last...
The north here, you're talking about Hezbollah.
Israel's north of Hezbollah, Israel. The Lebanese-Israeli border and the Syrian-Israeli border, which is now really one contiguous front. And there's a lot of fighting going on the Syrian line and the Lebanese line with Israel. Anyway, there what
And
you
the
see,
Syrian line is up at the Golan?
It's the Golan Heights line, yes. Golan Heights, Syrian border. And the Israelis lost 5 soldiers the first week. They haven't lost any since. And worse for Hezbollah is every time one of their squads gets close to the border and tries to set up launching an anti-tank missile, it's vaporized before it even sets up. So the Israelis now have good penetration in. Nobody's paying attention, but Israel's hitting some very high-value, painful targets for Hezbollah and, I may add, the Syrian army itself. They're hitting, they hit 2 key forces that are part of the Syrian regime's ability to survive in 2 places. One was Izra, and another one was just north of there. These are critical strategic nodes and critical strategic brigades, and Israel destroyed them.
And the object is to keep them out of the war. As much as anything, is it not?
I think it's to keep them out of the war for the moment, but it's also to operationally degrade them. And Hezbollah is beginning to operationally degrade. It's not at all like the level that Hamas is operationally degrading. But the Israelis are not just hitting back a unit or a squad that hit them. They are hitting strategic targets, and they are weakening Hezbollah.
Does that include, to your knowledge, David, this immense cache of missiles and rockets that they've been threatening Israel with for quite some time? Iranian-supplied, predominantly.
They might have hit some storage facilities. There was, this morning in Homs, a tremendous explosion underground that Israel clearly was involved with, an airplane attack, and it shook the earth in an unprecedented way around Homs. So it's more likely than not that Israel hit a deep underground storage facility and could have been using bunker buster bombs or something like that. But I don't know if they're, I don't believe they're hitting launcher after launcher. They're not degrading the launchers too much. So because that could trigger the massive wave of missiles. So I think they're degrading Hezbollah infrastructure and military community.
David, we're going to probably want to go longer on this than might otherwise seem appropriate. But I think because it's prompting so much controversy, particularly in the midst of this information warfare that has been one of Hamas's principal techniques for trying to counter what Israel is up to and garner international support for their cause and so on, is the claim that Israel is doing immense harm to civilians in Gaza for the moment. It's clear, I think, anybody who's familiar with Israeli doctrine, that it does not deliberately target civilians. And yet when you're attacking the kind of urban concentrated area that it is in northern Gaza in particular at the moment, despite what's been done to try to get people to leave and to minimize harm to innocent civilians, what's your assessment of how Israel is doing there? And are the claims that it's engaged in horrific war crimes and collective punishment and the like unwarranted?
No, I mean, if they were engaged collective punishment, they wouldn't have told anybody to leave and they would have just carpet bombed, which is roughly what every other military in the world does.
Ours included at a point.
Ours included in Fallujah. I think what you're hearing and seeing coming out of Gaza is just a larger form of the hospital story, where their own missile hit the hospital and everybody bought what Hamas said lock, stock, and barrel, and it took a week to clear it and to clear it all out and make it and understand this was a self-inflicted wound, not an Israeli deliberate attack of a hospital.
But on the information warfare point, within minutes of there being any explosion at all, and it turns out it was in, as I understand it, the parking lot near the hospital, there were claims that 500 people had been killed and that there were, you know, huge casualties and the hospital itself had been devastated and the like. It, as you say, maybe a week later, it was generally accepted that that was all wrong. But did the truth really ever catch up? Were there ever any corrections issued or otherwise? Did Israel get its reputation back?
It got its reputation back because other countries have seconded Israel's intelligence analysis using their own, whether it's European Union countries. The United States obviously said it had independent information, that it was not an Israeli missile. Europeans concluded it was at most 10, maybe 20 or so killed to begin with, not 500.
In the parking lot.
In the parking lot. Yeah, so there, I mean, there's all that. But, you know, one has to understand Hamas operates on many levels. One is they lie. People who cut babies' heads off also lie. And they lie. And they lie about everything, including this. And yet there is no ministry of health in Gaza that isn't Hamas run. Even UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, is Hamas run. So you're depending on Hamas information every time you listen to the number of dead and so on and so forth. And we know that they're lies. They gave us a list of 8,000 people dead with names. The Israelis only have 1,500 people dead. It's a Western country. And they still only identified 700 to 800 of them. But Hamas manages to turn these lists of thousands out within a minute. So you know it's fake.
And this is information warfare. And this I think in a very literal sense, it's being used to wage war against Israel. But, David, we have to take another break where you have to, merciless march of the clock. But we'll come right back and pick up on the point that you wanted to make and more with Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. FBI Director Christopher Wray warned Congress yesterday that, quote, we are in a dangerous period as multiple terrorist organizations have called for attacks against Americans and the West, unquote. Worse yet, when asked if any such groups were operating in the United States, Wray responded, quote, well, we're not tracking that, unquote. What the FBI has been tracking are patriotic Americans who were in Washington on January 6th, school board protesting parents, traditional Catholics, and those criticizing the COVID jabs. While such misallocation of limited counterintelligence resources tracks with disastrous Biden administration priorities, any conscientious public servant would resign for his part in leaving the nation acutely vulnerable to murderous strikes by jihadists and, for that matter, Chinese special forces and others now here to do us harm. The FBI needs an overhaul and new leadership. If Christopher Wray won't resign, he should be fired. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're doing an update and stocktaking on the state of the war between Israel and Hamas, and perhaps some of its allies, that began with a merciless surprise invasion of the nation of Israel on a holy day, and with a lot of very skillful disinformation, misinformation, concealment, deceptions, and the like. David, we're witnessing, as we've been talking about, some of that deception and misinformation and distortions and so on continuing to the detriment of Israel. It's certainly garnering the attention, and I think it's fair to say, in some quarters at least, support from governments, the UN, and the like. What's your sense of how the information war is going and the role in particular in all of this of some of those non-governmental organizations, UN and otherwise, that should be at best, non-combatants and out of the action doing, genuine relief work? And that doesn't seem to be the case, does it?
Well, it's these third party, these non-governmental organizations are providing a sort of veneer of independence or third party validation to disinformation. Or one last point about Hamas, they kill their own people. And we have evidence of that, that they kill their own people to make it look like Israel, not only by accident, in one of the humanitarian corridors that Israel set up. We saw cars being hit by a huge explosion, and it was instantly put out that that was Israel bombing the very humanitarian corridor that they said they were providing safe passage to. And further an examination of those films by the West turned out that was a car bomb they planted themselves to make it look like an Israeli, and they killed people. The truth is the Israelis are being extremely meticulous. They're still using self-defeating practices. Like they still warn buildings before they bomb them, and stuff like that. As far as the NGOs go, they're echo chambers for Hamas propaganda, and they're willfully serving as that. And this gets, to some extent, the question of the cutoff of the internet and communications. This is dangerous because it's not only just a disinformation war that is being prosecuted through these channels, and obviously in any war, internal communications need to be cut. The very first thing any army does is to hit communications towers so they can't communicate among themselves. Well, the internet today is how that's done. But more importantly, we see around the world attacks on Jews, attacks on the West, signaling. This is going to lead somewhere to a slaughter of more people. And Hamas is directing these external acts of violence, whether it's in universities in America or the streets of Berlin, where they're marking off Jewish buildings and stores, etc. This is preparation for a slaughter. And Hamas is using these communication structures as part of its war to essentially order its minions abroad to kill. So this is
and that incident in Dagestan, I think it's pretty clear had Israelis been present or Jews been present, they would have been torn to pieces by that mob. So it's right. It's a ticking time bomb, and it's being, you know, intensified obviously by Hamas. So David, when you talk about the civilian part of this, the question keeps coming up. Why don't these people simply get out of Gaza? And it's a very instructive answer that needs to be illuminated in this context concerning the attitude of not just the Egyptians, but everybody else, I gather, in the region as well.
Well, there's three, I think, three very instructive things that come out of it. The first of it is Hamas turns its gun on its own people. It basically, at gunpoint, holds them their own people hostage to prevent Israeli attacks. So they're willing to sacrifice their own people easily to save themselves. There's that wonderful meme where you have, on one side, an Israeli soldier protecting a baby carriage behind him, and then the Hamas soldier shooting at the Israeli soldier with a baby carriage in front of him. That's one thing. The second thing, which you're referring to, is the fact that as much as every Arab country is screaming and yelling about the rights of Palestinians and safety of Palestinians, none have taken any in, even temporarily in across the border, even slightly like Egypt, to just get them out of harm's way. And then the last thing is, and this is the really disturbing thing, the assumption that the president had, President Biden had, that Hamas is Hamas, but the Palestinians have to be differentiated, and that they don't really support Hamas. The vast majority aren't like this. It's just not true. And unfortunately, there is a large amount, probably a substantial majority of people in Gaza who still support at least Hamas, at least doing this to the Israelis. They may have their own gripes internally, but in terms of actually doing what they did against Israeli babies and so forth, the polls show vast support. And many of them are not going, they want to stand and fight with the Israelis. And so I think some are just willfully cooperating with being human shields.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to that point we started with about Sharia, you know, if they're adherent. And let's be clear, not all Muslims are Sharia adherent. Unfortunately, in places like Gazastan, they generally are. And if they haven't been adherent, they've generally met an unsavory fate at the hands, again, of the guys roaming the place, Hamas. So, David, to the extent that we're looking at a situation that will entail for some period of time, Israel presumably dividing and conquering Gaza, we do need to talk about the end game in all of this. And we're going to have to take a final break just for a few moments. And when we come back, we'll get your thoughts on not only with respect to Hamas, what's the end game, but also with respect to those who've enabled it to perpetrate this horror and so much other harm to Israel. Actual and potential. We'll be right back with more on that with David Wormser. Stay tuned. We're back for the final segment of our very important conversation with one of the smartest guys I know, period, but also when it comes to matters involving the Middle East and the forces at work there that have made peace such an exception and the prospects of it, dim as they are at the moment, properly so, given what has happened to Israel in the recent days. David, so I asked you before the break to think about or talk with us about the thinking you've been doing, more to the point, about where do we go from here? What is the end game, as you see it, for Israel, both with respect to Gaza and perhaps its allies, who are still champing at the bit, it seems, to wage war against Israel as well?
I mean, on the most immediate level, you hear a lot of stuff coming from Western capitals that the Israelis don't have a concept for an exit strategy from Gaza. And they're right, because Israel doesn't have a concept. At the moment, they're thinking about reoccupation and that that's the only safe option left for them at the moment. That's code for, in foreign capitals, for trying to resurrect the Palestinian Authority and bring them back into Gaza and continue happily with the Oslo framework of two-state solution. In Israel, having been there for the first 3 weeks of the war, that is dead. There is not going to be a revived Oslo process. The Israelis have been burned horribly by this, and that's really the origin of where this all began, is the idea that they can safely cede territory within their heartland and not be hit with it, whether it's the terrorism that they faced 15 years ago from the PLO or this. So, but there's no solution that the Israelis can come up with in the current strategic environment, because they're in a strategic war with Iran. And this is part of that war with Iran. So the immediate strategic endgame is to leverage this violence, this war, to administer to Iran itself a profound regional strategic blow and reestablish Israel as the strong horse of the region rather than the lame donkey. That also allows Israel to continue to build its alliance structure with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and so forth, which serves as a very good anchor for Western interests in the region when we really need to be shifting our assets to Asia and Europe. And this really is a nice, strong foundation for the West. But this all is predicated on a major Israeli strategic victory, which really can only be done not only through Gaza and reoccupying Gaza, but by destroying Hezbollah and the Syrian government, which is the strategic foundation for Iran's presence in the Levant, East Levant, West Levant, and from that, ripple effects and direct attack, perhaps, on the nuclear program or even regime symbolic targets by Israel in Iran itself that throw the Iranian regime back on its hind heels, knowing that the Iranian people themselves hate their regime.
Yeah. I did want to just emphasize that point, David, because you talked about a kind of existential threat from Iran. You mean, and I understood you to mean, from the Iranian regime. It's not the case, is it fair to say, that unlike the people of Gaza supporting their jihadi rulers, the people of Iran, some obviously, but the majority, I think it's fair to say, in Iran do not support their jihadi rulers.
When you look right now at all the demonstrations around the country, the pro-Israeli demonstrations, you will see Iranians participating with the Israelis. When you see Iranian opposition figures, what they're saying, and now I'm seeing graffiti in Iran appearing all over the place that is basically saying the Israeli army will avenge your eyes. That's because the Iranian regime, what it does to demonstrate is it shoots at their eyes. They shoot bird pellets at the eyes to blind the protesters. So the symbol has become the one-eyed protester or the blind protester in Iran. So that's why you see these slogans all over the walls, all over Iran, that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, will avenge your eyes. This is powerful stuff in Iran. The Iranian people themselves are saying that Israel's army is the agent of their revenge. So you can, the Iranian people for 2,500 years have had very good relations with the Jewish people. And in many cases, strong strategic allies, even going back to Cyrus the Great. So there's no reason for this conflict other than the radical Islamist regime of the Iranian currently in Iran,
who, as you say, brutalize their own people but threaten Israel. And by the way, threaten us, as really do all of the other elements of this, axis of evil, as you called it at the beginning.
Yeah.
So, David, what are we doing? And is what we're doing helpful to the strategic, decisive victory that Israel must achieve?
I think what we're doing is we're giving Israel some ammunition and weapons so that they can focus on getting rid of Hamas. That's where the convergence ends, though. It's to get rid of Hamas so that the PLO can move back in. That's, I think, the dream of this administration. Otherwise, they're trying to deter Iran or to convince Iran not to engage because they don't believe this is a strategic event. And they don't want this to turn into an Israeli-Iranian strategic conflict where Israel emerges victorious. And on one level, even further, they don't see this as part of a much larger global move toward a dangerous world. It really is this Tolkien thing of there's a sleepless malice that stirs and it's on the move. You feel it when you're there. I suppose you feel it in Kiev, and I suppose they're feeling it quite seriously now in Seoul, in Korea, in Taiwan. There's definitely a global threat emerging, and they're all aligned, our enemies, and it's becoming acute. There's no realization of that yet in Washington. And it hopefully this wakes people up that we don't have enough ammunition. We're not even in wartime footing of ammunition. We're running out.
Or in any other respect, I think it's fair to say. And David, this is the critical takeaway from all of this, I think, is that this war is not just about Israel and Gaza, for sure. It is, I think, one phase of a global war. And we're in it. And unfortunately, at the moment, we're poorly led in the fight, and I'm afraid it's encouraging our enemies. We have to leave it at that, David. We've scratched the surface, I think, handsomely, but still there's more to talk about, and we hope we can do so with you soon. In the meantime, Godspeed, my friend, and keep up the great work at the Center for Security Policy.
Thank you.
Look forward to talking to the rest of you next time, and then until then, go forth and multiply.